All right, and we will move on now to the fifth case for this morning, United States against Bell. Mr. McGowan.
May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Andrew J. McGowan. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois, and I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. L.C. Bell.
Before you get into the arguments that you've already briefed, should this be remanded back for resentencing in light of Kimbrough, or do you think this is one that...
Under 3582, as I understand it, this was a crack case, and his sentence was based on that. So I would say yes.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to get that out up front before you went to.
In this case, otherwise, he Mr. Bell appeals the district court's upholding of the warrant.
Right. I understand you've got substantive attacks, but I thought it should go back because of Kimbrough. I just wanted to know your views. Okay.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. The officer in this case, to request the warrant, offered an affidavit. The problem with the affidavit was that it was included information from various sources that don't have any indication that they're reliable necessarily. There are two sets of sources, I call them anyway, unnamed arrestees and confidential informants. They give very conclusory statements. They're over a period of 3 months, and there's really nothing in those statements necessarily to indicate that they're reliable or that the information is correct.
Let me ask you a general question. In some cases, you have a situation where an informant will say, and let's assume for the sake of my discussion, it's an anonymous informant, not somebody the police have worked with. An informant will say something like what this person said. I was just in Smith's residence, and I saw, a scale, or I saw a printer for counterfeit money, or I saw drugs, or I saw something. And so then that's repeated. Do we need to evaluate that statement based on corroboration that's available before the search is executed, or is that statement somehow capable of corroboration by the fact that later on, when the search is executed, it turns out, in this instance, there are the two plastic baggies and there's the currency and so on?
I think clearly this court's case law, and in fact all the case law that I'm aware of, would not allow any kind of later discoveries
after
to corroborate anything
mm-hmm.
in the affidavit.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that it turned out to be correct doesn't really help.
So in other words, we have to look at this affidavit from an ex-ante perspective. What did the police know? Now, the police did know at the time they executed this affidavit that Mr. Bell had prior arrests and convictions for violations of the Illinois Controlled Substances Act and armed robbery. What else did they know?
Well, they knew the information from the other informant who was named Mr. Hale, that wasn't his real name, who indicated that he was in the house or in the apartment, I think, the night before.
Do we know if the police officer, Mr. Ensley, knew who Mr. Hale was and was just using the name for purposes of the affidavit, or if the informant was using an assumed name even with Ensley?
I don't think we know that from the affidavit. I think a reasonable inference is that the officer probably knew who this person was and was protecting his identity, which happens quite frequently in these sorts of cases.
Mm-hmm.
But even so, even if the officer knew him, the problem is that he's submitting it to a judge for an evaluation. And the problem in this case is that there's nothing other than what the person said, which this court has called conclusory statements, to establish the person's reliability. And without that kind of information, who knows if what is in the affidavit is true or not? And this court has not required officers to do much in the past. A little corroboration for acts, for instance, if the person actually lives where the informant says he lives. The informant, in fact, in this case, refers to a woman who lives there. They could have confirmed that a woman lived there. There are a number of things.
So they had put into the affidavit, and we went and looked at 1601 9th Street and saw in the mailbox L.C. Bell, or something. That would have been...
That would strengthen this argument considerably. There doesn't take a whole lot of facts to establish probable cause, as this court's well aware. But in this case, with the information that this officer has provided the judge, it's just clearly deficient. you just look at it and you go, well, how is anybody supposed to determine whether this person is telling the truth or not? And it would have helped. In other words, this court has found in the past that it would have helped if the person giving the information had inculpated himself somehow by saying he was
penal interest.
Exactly, saying, well, I bought some drugs from this person. That's not necessarily the be-all and end-all of it, but it would help somebody else looking at this saying, wow, this guy is also incriminating himself at the same time he's giving this information. There's some information, there's some indication that this person's telling the truth.
Well, that would be especially true if your speculation that Officer Ensley knew who Hale was somehow reflected here, because if a known person makes a statement against penal interest, he's putting himself at risk.
The other thing that could...
Can I ask you about your good faith argument for just
sure.
a minute? I want to know whether you think the officers should have read the decisions in Peck and Kurth, or whether there's just something about these facts that don't get to the point of good faith.
Your Honor, the test that this court has used to evaluate good tests has been around for a long time. It's very simple. It's the personal observations, the details, the corroboration, and whether the person appears before the judge. Another thing that didn't happen in this case, which is especially disheartening from the government's point of view, if the officer knew who the person was. Given that test has been around, of course, there are a lot of variations on this. We've cited two cases that we think are appropriate. I think Kurth is really very close to this case, and the government has cited Olson, which comes off slightly on the other side. But I think the difference there is that in Olson, he made not only an incriminatory statement about the offense that he was arrested for, but he also included that he was trying to get some drugs, so he was including himself in different kinds of offenses. That didn't happen in this case either. But we think that because these cases have been around, I don't think the officer needs to read them. Obviously, the district court hadn't read them until they came up. But we think that the officers dealing with prosecutors and judges have an obligation to understand that if they don't have something in the affidavit to confirm that the person's reliable, that somebody else can look at it and say, oh, yeah, that could be reliable, that they have to do something else. So then
your position would be that even though there was corroboration by more than one informant and a criminal record check, and the observation of this informant who took an assumed name, that is not enough for good faith purposes.
You know, as the years go by, I think it becomes less and less. This court affirmed Kurth simply because of the good faith exception. We think this is very close to Kurth, and in fact, Kurth had stronger facts in it because of the inculpatory statements.
So do you think then, let me put it slightly differently, that the problem is that the other people who supposedly corroborated this were themselves also anonymous? All we know is that there are numerous individuals who were acting as confidential sources.
Numerous or several. We actually don't know how many numbers.
Numerous.
We don't know anything about them. We just absolutely know nothing about them. And as judges, you understand how important it is to be able to evaluate the basis of people's information. There's no information about how they know, whether they were involved in buys with this person, whether they heard it from third persons or fourth persons. There's just nothing in there to indicate that it would otherwise be reliable. And we think that over time, over the court's cases, especially Peck and Kurth, and even Olson, I mean, if you take away Olson's inculpatory statements, this court was very, very close in that case, as far as I could tell. And for these reasons, we request that the court not follow the good faith exception in this case. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for you. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Cox.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Richard Cox, on behalf of the United States. If I may, let me first address Judge Williams' question about Kimbrough. Mr. Bell was subject to a mandatory minimum sentence of 120 months. His range, if I recall right, was 120 to 150. Judge McCuskey gave him the top of that range, 150. So there could be a Kimbrough issue, but sentencing was not a factor in this case. I wasn't present for the sentencing. I don't know, for instance, if Judge McCuskey made any statements that I would have given you the top of the guideline range in any event. So I can't specifically answer your question, but I know he couldn't go below 120 months.
Okay. We need some briefing on that, Mr. Cox.
Okay. We can certainly do
that. Within 10 days of argument, submit statements about whether a Kimbrough remand is appropriate on these facts, should we decide to
The only problem with the 10 days, Your Honor, might be getting a sentence in transcript, but
okay,
wasn't prepared.
Right.
But we will certainly be
right,
in touch.
I'll tell you, we'll issue an order later this afternoon that will specify a period of time, and if that turns out not to be enough, you can come back and let us know.
Do our absolute best, Your Honor. Thank you. If I could first just turn to the good faith issue. This court has said that I won't say it's strong, but they say it's certainly evidence of an officer's good faith when competent judges have previously determined that the facts that that officer presented for a search warrant, in fact, establish probable cause.
But could I say, too, Mr. Cox, I'm glad you're starting there, because this affidavit really has nothing in it that would tell you before the search happens anything about these people who are making the allegations. The only thing we have here is prior arrests, and there are an awful lot of people walking around with a record. And so I think this case rises or falls on good faith, and this is not the same. I mean, you've argued Olson, but there was so much more in Olson than there is here.
Well, in Olson, Your Honor, I think the only thing that really said difference in Olson is that there were statements against that informant's penal interest. He admitted that he had broken into his uncle's
home. That's huge, though. I mean, that's a really big point.
We have a confidential informant here, and I certainly take your point. I think the inference is that the police officer knew who he was. It was not an anonymous tipster. What he says is, I spoke with Rob Hale and assumed, using an assumed name.
It just says Rob Hale, an assumed name. It's another thing that's unsatisfactory about this. But even if we assumed for the sake of the good faith argument that perhaps the issuing judge was under the impression that the officer knew, we don't know anything about why Hale might have known this. So, for example, we don't know if Hale had some bias against Mr. Bell. Maybe, you know, they'd had an unfortunate encounter in the past. Maybe they had a grudge. I mean, we know nothing about Hale.
I certainly agree. Other than that, we know that, at least if you believe him, he was in the apartment on several occasions.
But how do we know we can trust? The Supreme Court has stressed you need some hook for understanding why these confidential informants are reliable.
I understand that, Your Honor. I can't stand here and say this is the greatest warrant.
I could say I've been in Mr. Bell's apartment in the past, and how would you know?
Well, I think if you compare it to the other cases, some of it's the level of detail. He described the cocaine was in two separate packages.
He's a storyteller. I mean, you could say anything, because now you're really slipping over into the post hoc corroboration trap, and we can't go there.
I wasn't trying to use the what happened afterwards. I was just explaining that unlike in the Peck case, for instance, where the informant, the girlfriend, just said, I saw cocaine in the house. She never described where it was, how it was packaged, what the quantity was. Here,
she's the girlfriend, and so you know beforehand that she would have some reason to know what was in that house. People have grudges against other people. They might make up some plausible-sounding story about someone and tell a police officer, and that's that.
I understand that, Your Honor. And in fact, just to dwell on that for a moment, it is against the law to lie to police officers. And assuming, and I agree with you, but assuming that in this case that Officer Ensley knew who Rob Hale was, who he really was, there is some reason to think that perhaps that information is true, knowing that I, as a police officer, can go to my state's attorney and say, he came to me and for malicious reasons, totally unfounded, identified Mr. Bell as a crack cocaine dealer, and he wasn't. And in my experience, I can tell you that I've seen that happen. It's rare. I don't mean it happens every day, but certainly it has happened.
So what happens to your case if Ensley himself is dealing with somebody and the guy says, I'm going to call myself Rob Hale for purposes of dealing with you because I really don't want you to know any more than that about me?
Well, that Ensley doesn't know who the person
is? Right. Right. That Ensley's got this informant, and the informant says, call me Rob, but makes it clear that he really doesn't want Ensley to know anything more.
Well, if he knows, Officer Ensley knows who the person really is, it seems to me it doesn't change the situation.
But I'm saying, suppose he doesn't.
If he doesn't know, that makes my argument even weaker. I absolutely agree.
And the thing is, even in your situation where we're supposing that he actually knows him, we just don't know anything about their relationship. There are no details whatsoever.
I agree, Your Honor. I think I said in Peck when I stood up here that if I was drafting this warrant, I think I would have drafted a better affidavit. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm confident I would have drafted a better affidavit. I've been doing it for too long, and I know the potential ramifications. But at least in our district, oftentimes warrants come to us after the fact from state authorities.
From the state court. We know that.
And we do our best to train police officers that we can, and we try to encourage them to contact us before they do that. But most of the time, like in this situation, mm-hmm. everything's done when it comes to our office. And, in fact, you get a phone call that says, we got a search warrant, which right there at least is something, and we found, you know, guns, we found drugs or whatever. Are you interested in taking this case? Because it's a question then about who's going to proceed.
Even with Leon, though, some things are so lacking that they fall on the inadequate side of the line. I mean, Leon doesn't say, as long as you've gone to get a warrant, you're fine. Now, the Supreme Court could have said that. Maybe they will say that someday. But that's not what Leon says.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And they say that if police officers essentially should have been aware that the affidavit that they presented to the judge did not contain probable cause, then they didn't act in good faith.
And that's that's an objective inquiry.
But it just seems to me that when you have I think of it this way. I have tried to determine why a police officer, without knowing what the judge is going to do with the information he takes to him, would essentially, with an evil conscience, say, I'm going to take an affidavit that I do not believe contains probable cause to this judge.
But see, there's where I think we want to get into objective. Let's assume Officer Ensley has just written up this thing and he's put in all this very speculative information that no police officer should really rely on. You know, maybe he is mistaken, you know, and the like, but if it's objectively a completely inadequate affidavit, I don't think Leon applies. You think he has to have an evil motive before Leon applies?
No, I'm not. I don't mean to suggest that. What I'm saying is I'm just trying to figure out why a police officer would ever put himself in that position.
It'd be sloppy.
Just hasty.
Yeah.
He couldn't be sloppy, but then that wouldn't be evil. I'm just saying when he knows, I do not have probable cause, why would I take, as a police officer, why would I take that to a judge? I think what more often happens is a police officer, this is all I have. And I'm not saying he couldn't have done more. If he would have come and talked to me, I could have said, there's some other things you could do. But I think they think, under the time constraints they're operating, this is what I have. I'm going to take it to the judge. And if the judge thinks this is sufficient, then that's okay. And again, I'm not excusing that, Your Honor. I'm not saying that that satisfies Leon, but it certainly shows that the police officer is not acting in bad faith.
No, I mean, that's why I say, if the court had just said, the mere act of walking in and presenting your case to either a state judge or a United States magistrate or whoever happens to be issuing warrants in that area, that's a good thing. You know, you're now making yourself accountable to somebody. It's one of the purposes of the warrant requirement. But we've needed a little more than that to get over Leon.
In the police officer, from his perspective, I will say in this case, he had someone who came to him who said, I have been in this house, described the house, what the address was, knew it was the upstairs apartment on the east end. The police officer knew that was the only such address, having an upstairs east apartment in all of the county he operated in. Said that within that 24 hours, I've been in there, I saw this cocaine, it was packaged in two plastic baggies, I saw a gun underneath the couch. He described that the cocaine was on a table in the living room. I think from the police officer's perspective, he thinks this information is pretty darn detailed, and that's probably sufficient. But it also, then he says, I have been investigating crack cocaine sales in my county for the last 2 months, I think, several months. People I have arrested have told me that Mr. Bell is selling crack cocaine. And in addition to that, I have confidential informants that I'm using in these investigations who also tell me. So from his perspective, he thinks I have a lot of information that says that Mr. Bell has crack cocaine in his house. So I think that when he then takes that to the judge and says, please issue a warrant, and the judge does so, it just seems to me that there's not a very strong argument that he's operating in bad faith.
Okay.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Cox. We'll give you a minute, Mr. McGowan.
That won't be necessary.
No, okay.
Thank you.
No, thank you. The case will be taken under advisement in that case. We thank both counsel.
Sure.